Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Savage Beast. I'm Matt Colgate, a.k.a. Lord Nuneaton Savage, and with me on the other side of the screen is Dan White, a.k.a. The Beast Must Die.
Howdy.
And we're taking it easy tonight, listeners. We're relaxing, we're putting our feet up. We came up with a whole bunch of different ideas for this programme, and basically so much has happened in both our lives in the last few weeks, and it's basically become impossible to sit down and just address ourselves in the way that we normally would to a Savage Beast show. Because believe it or not, it is quite meticulously worked out what we normally do.
So it may not sound like it, but it is.
In the slightest. But yeah, so we've decided that we're just going to relax. We've cracked open a couple of cans, because we don't normally do that.
No.
And we're just going to talk about some of the films that we've watched recently. Those of you who remember our Christmas party special around Christmas time, we'll get the format. We're going to sit back. We're going to shoot the shit. We're going to talk about some movies we've seen. You might have seen some. You might not. Join in the conversation. Why don't you? But you can't now because, you know, it's not live.
You could have to do it mentally, but that's fine.
Yeah, but that's fun. And so we're just gonna take it easy and just talk about some films that we've watched and things that we've enjoyed or not. As the
this is our summer special, our summer holiday special, isn't it?
Yeah, it's our bumper comic full of like quizzes and like word searches
and reprints. Yeah, the noble art of the British holiday special.
This time not in colour.
Yeah. we like you said, we're just gonna chat about some films really, and hopefully it will be enjoyable for you. We'll be back the next episode. We'll be back to a thematic one, but as Matt said, it was just sometimes actually just sort of finding the time to get your head into like the space required and even just tracking down the films sometimes once you've decided on them can be a bit of a challenge. I don't know if you've noticed this. This is something I've found. It's like a special, there should be like a Sod's Law, but it's a special kind of law where when you're scrolling through, you know, the whatever, you know, services you have, and you just keep seeing films that come up, you know, not this time. And then sometimes we will go, oh, right, let's do an episode about X. And then you think, oh, cool. I know that's on Prime and I know it's free. And then when you go, it suddenly isn't free. It's like it's sensed that you've finally got around to, like when we did the Italian, not the Italian, the religious horror one, The Church was just on Prime for free for ages. It was just sitting there. And then I was like, hey, great. I don't have to pay for that one. Suddenly it was like, no, going to have to rent that. It turns out.
£3.50 like, for you.
Yeah. I mean, luckily the kind of films we watch generally are in the lower price bracket.
In the lower end of the bracket. Yeah. I think that's called Pod's Law. Mm. I think that's...
It's definitely called a first world problem as well.
But it was quite funny because like one of the, we came up with one theme for a show. And we went to look for the films involved. And it's really funny how some films have, I mean, they've gone. Mm. Like, these are films that are made, like, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and they're just gone. You just can't get them. And it's so weird to think that, you know, when you had the sort of, you know, august institutions like the BFI and stuff like that started restoring the old 20s and 30s films, you know, You still hear about films that, you know, films like Queen of Sheba that they reckon they'll never, ever be able to see the light of day. These enormous epics in the 30s. They're like, well, they just don't exist anymore. And you wonder if perhaps, like, you know, some of these, you know, low-grade horror movies from 2005 are basically the equivalent of, like, the contemporary equivalent of the Queen of Sheba. They'll be reconstructing, like, photos of Billy Bob Thornton in thousands of years. Nothing of this man's work survives.
Yeah, I think there's a big resurgence due for like the 90s and people being like uncovering like, you know, these kind of lost 90s artifacts because that's just an unloved period, isn't it?
It really is. They're blowing sand off the ancient VHS copies of fucking Marley and
3.
Wishmaster 3, yeah. The thing is, it's funny because it's true. There's actually people doing that now, aren't there?
But you know, it's funny because Wishmaster is probably a clunky but almost appropriate link into the first film that we want to talk about.
I didn't even think of that. That's very good.
Just nice about work. Works, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, I'm down with that. That'll do for me.
So what's the first one we're going to talk about?
Let's have a chat about Candisha.
C'est quoi ça?
C'est quoi ça, elle blesse d'un mec?
C'est une femme plutôt. Du genre à faire flipper même ceux qui se la racontent grave.
Pourquoi tu réponds pas à mes appels?
Si on l'a appelé pour se venger de toi.
Candisha!
C'est elle qui a poursuivi Farine.
Franchement, Amélie, je crois vraiment que t'as réussi à invoquer un fantôme de ta salle de bain.
Je suis trop sûre pour aller voir un truc.
Non, ça va.
Yeah, so yeah, I watched this a couple of weeks ago, and you watched it, I think, the other night, didn't you?
I watched it last night, yeah. It's a Shudder film, and I've kept my Shudder subscription, but I've got to admit, I haven't sat down and watched a lot of stuff recently. But they have been doing much more regular updates of, like, contemporary films than they were a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, it used to be quite slow, Shudder, in terms of getting new stuff up. But they've really ramped it up. Yeah. And there's been some really good, I say good looking, like stuff I'm actually really looking forward to seeing. Like that Relic is up on Shudder, and that film Sator that everyone's been going on about, which I'm really excited to see, that's up there. So, you know, good independent fare has started appearing. And I wanted to watch Candisha because I saw that you'd reviewed it and you'd said you'd quite liked it. And also, it's directed by, I think it's Eric Bustillo and Julian Mowry, who are the guys that made Inside, which is a à l'intérieur, which is a film I like a great deal, mainly because it's just relentless extremity.
Yeah, it's one of the name-checked kind of French extreme films, Inside. I've never seen
very
it.
Much so, yeah.
Yeah, is it the one about the woman, the pregnant woman, trying to defend herself from?
I
might come to that.
It's definitely it's a really, like, you know, don't be wrong. It's a hysterically pitched gore fest, but it is quite a fun movie inside. It's like one of the things I like about Inside is that despite its kind of, like, you know, extremist nature, it's kind of really hokey. And, you know, the directors kind of know how daft their material is, but they just sort of play it really hard. Like, it's one of those films where, like, you know, it's basically a two-hander, you know, because it's this mad woman trying to get inside to this flat to basically cut the baby out of a pregnant woman. But it's like the directors are kind of like, we only have two people. That's quite boring. So they have to keep coming up with these ridiculous reasons why other people are going to turn up around this flat so this woman can kill them. Because it's like they realise halfway through, right, it's like, yeah, we're only going to be able to kill like one person at the most if we don't contrive some ridiculous reasons why someone else has to come around this house.
Is there like a New Year's party conga line at any point coming
through? Yeah, there's like a chainsaw out the door just taking the heads off one by one. But it's actually like, yeah, despite its sort of relentless extremity, it's actually quite a goofy, quite a fun movie. And I've got to say, I went into Candisha, and the whole setup of Candisha really had me thinking that we were going to get another, you know, what we call a sort of a little bit of a Babadookification film, where it's like, okay, it's a horror film, but it's actually about inner city deprivation and, you know, cross, you know, the banlieues of outside Paris and stuff. That's what it's actually about. And it's like, no, this is a straight up blast of a gory horror film. And I had a great time with this film, actually, because I wasn't expecting it to go quite as hard and quite as splattery as it did. And it really, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no. I mean, I know what you mean, because I think what, the reason I kind of liked it was similar, that it was a fairly naked riff on Candyman. I mean, I think I said in one of my review that I, you know, it was a literal sort of cross between La Haine and Candyman, and it really is. But you know, I have no problem with that either. I'm like, I you know, some of my favourite things are either kind of rip-offs or homages or whatever, or someone just riffing on a good idea in a different way or whatever. So, but it is very much like, you know, those two things spliced together. But what I liked was that fundamentally it was a really creepy and nasty kind of vengeful ghost story, but was just with a really different and interesting set dressing. So yeah. Instead of a bunch of, you know, unlikable American teens, you know, sort of reasonably prosperous white American teens with maybe a token black friend, it was, this kind of racially mixed group of, like, graffiti tagging inner city girls who all were all kind of really quite deftly characterized and given, like, you know, strong and interesting identities and all that stuff. But really ultimately it was just like, it's just one of those films, but isn't it interesting when it's not the same old people in the role? And yeah. And as you say though, but it wasn't actually the Babadook effect of like, you know, we're going to try and sort of get past the irritating genre trappings and just get to the meat of this, you know, meditation on grief and guilt and stuff, you know. And it's like, no, this has got a monster in it, and the monster fucks people up. Yeah. Really picks them up as well.
I mean, it's we should probably explain. So basically it's a rape revenge story at its heart.
Yeah.
But the revenge takes the supernatural form of a figure called Aisha Candisha, who is I suppose a kind of brutally wronged woman from the past. So now is the she's like the spirit of vengeance for wronged women, isn't she? She takes it out on literally every male in their social circle. So yes. one of our protagonists, our ostensible heroine, after mistreatment by a boy, ex-boyfriend. Calls upon this vengeful spirit which her friend with Moroccan ancestry has told her about, and all hell breaks loose and everybody dies. And it's like, and it's such a whirlwind of revenge as well. It starts coming so fast that
what I like is it's the Candyman thing, of literally, like, you know, you summon it, and once you've summoned it, it's like, you know, that's, and it's a really, it's always been a really creepy idea, you know, look in the mirror, say the words, and then reap the price, you know. And what I like about this is that it sets up this idea that this is like the you know, a female spirit of vengeance, as you say, for kind of wronged women. But then it just is this kind of splatter shot effect where all these guys they know, and you know they're not bad. It's like there is a commentary about kind of misogyny and masculinity and the ease with which that kind of stuff just leaks into these young girls' lives and stuff, but they're also like self-possessed, strong and intimidating girls. And so in a way, it kind of plays on the idea that she sort of casually just invokes it. Not casually, I mean, she's been assaulted and stuff, but she gives as good as she gets in terms of the actual, you know, she fucks him up quite well. It's just that, you know, it goes south basically. And then she kind of invokes him, but it feels very much like a sort of act of like, fuck it, I'll just do this and that'll show him. And then actually it's just all of her like, nice male friends start getting offed as well, and it's not really like, oh, but you know, misogyny is kind of it comes in many forms. It's not really saying that. It's sort of saying this is just a spirit of vengeance. You want to probably be careful when you sick these upon the world, because they tend to just act in it, you know. It very much leans into the idea that this is a kind of demonic force basically. Like there's a nice sort of viscerality about the kind of racial tension, the interplay between genders, all this stuff is just really high in the mix in the film, but it doesn't kind of settle into being a sort of finger waggy lecture or a kind of liberal you know, masturbatory sort of vengeance fantasy, or a right wing, you know, anti woke. It's none of those things, actually. It's just some really quite sort of believable characters, some quite heady themes, and then just a really, really nasty monster just tearing through the middle of it, really. Yeah. Ultimately. And it was good.
Yeah. Really good. I think the the thing that you take away from it is that I think as directors, they're very interested in the way that the young people are speaking. Do you know what I mean? Mm. A lot of the dialogue felt like it had probably been generated by the actors themselves.
Yes.
There was a real authenticity to it, which I really appreciate.
You really believed their friendship and their intimacy and their sort of, and the way they spoke to each other in this really like racially charged way. But they're all these like kind of, they're like B-girls basically. And so they're kind of, they go out and like tag up buildings and stuff like that. So they've got this, they've got a kind of nice punk rock sort of ballsy attitude, but they speak to each other. It's like really racially charged. They're just like talking about, you know, talking to each other in this really, but in this really sort of close affectionate way that makes you kind of, you know, it puts you right in it basically with them, but you kind of believe their friendship and stuff. And it doesn't feel like some kind of weird, like metaphor. Ah, this is a metaphor for Paris today, even though it probably is a little bit, you know, in the same way that Lehane was, you know, it was just like the same thing. But it all feels like really just, as you say, kind of in service of making characters who are a little bit different from what we see normally, really.
Yeah.
And refreshingly so.
And it's it's great how well that works, because I watched another film before it, and I'll talk about that other film afterwards, but it was really interesting because the other film that I watched beforehand was actually quite similar in that it's about a group of young people who have to face down a supernatural threat, and it's very much about the part of the city that they live in, you know, it's about the surrounding. But the group of young people in this, the first film I watched, it was just absolutely toothless. You know what I mean? It was very much a family version, a sanitized version of what inner city kids speak like. Mm-hmm. Whereas what this had was that kind of rawness and authenticity, but it also made you care. So that with the other film, where it was like kind of this sort of sanitized version, I was like, well, nothing bad's really going to happen to these kids because of the kind of film that this is and the way that it's playing out. It's going to be pretty toothless. And then when I saw this, I started off thinking the same thing. I was like, well, because you know when you still have a bit of hangover from the movie before?
Or previous film,
I was like, well, nothing's bad's going to happen to these kids. It's a bit like, and it's like, oh no, something awful is going to happen to all of these people. and it really hit me. I was like, oh, but I like these people. They're great. I don't want anything bad to happen to them.
There's one bit that's genuinely quite heartbreaking where mild spoilers, but one of the characters, one of their parents gets kind of, you know.
Wow,
And that bit is, a great bit of, like, gore. Like, it's
probably good.
Oh, that's good. But also, like, really is a gut punch. You know, and by that point as well, the film is just it's just gleefully killing people. It's just gleefully killing people.
Well, there's such a switch off point, isn't there? It's like, even with the first like two or I think maybe three killings, it still feels quite subtle. It's still quite artfully done. And then for reasons that we won't go into, those of you who don't like the idea of cruelty to animals in films, a thing happens to a rabbit in this film.
Yeah.
That I was just like, and I'm not one of these people who gets upset by animals being killed in horror films, but I was like covering my eyes with what was happening to that poor rabbit.
Yeah.
And it's just, and as soon as that bit happens, it's like the director's suddenly going,
Yeah.
Here we go.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I sort of thought, oh, okay, it's going down a bit more of a Ringu grudge thing where it's almost like you're not going to see people actually getting chopped up. And you know, when Aisha Khandisha first appears, she is kind of, you know, wraith-like rather than a monster, and that changes.
Yes.
So at first you're like, oh, is that going to be it? It's because, you know, she just appears, and you sort of, I mean, there's quite a good bit where she kind of like grows up out of the shadow and stuff, and you're like, oh yeah, that's creepy. But you know, ultimately she's just a sort of, you know, this ghost like figure really. And then it's like, not by the end, she's not.
it's got way more in common with a film like Lord of Illusions, where there's a real sort of grignol to it. But yeah, it's that I thought I was going to be watching something similar to Under the Shadow, because the spirit, the presence is quite similar. It's like a, yes, like a, almost like a, you know, like a floaty sheet to begin with that sort of pops up in places. I was like, okay, it's, I can see that there's a similarity perhaps with Under the Shadow. And then it's like, no, you are not. this is a monster movie, and a very satisfying one as well.
I think it gets better. I think the first couple of like kills are slightly mishandled. I think it's sort of it slightly misses a chance to be like genuinely creepy and spooky. Like I think that's the only thing. I think it hits its stride much better when it starts going for more, like say, more of the grignol. I think it's got a good creepy build up and stuff, but I think there's a couple of moments where you could probably have really delivered a couple of Grudge-like scares in there, which they sort of don't do very well. And there's a couple of odd choices that are made about how to stage things that sort of, and it kind of slightly, you know, made me go, oh, is this not going to deliver? But as you say, then it starts delivering. And it's got, there's a real brutality to it, which is fun. You know, and that sounds like an odd thing to say, but it is fun. You know, it does give you kind of a crunch. And the girl who kind of has invoked it just has a really good face for just increasingly like, what have I done? she's just so like, at first she's like, oh, whoops. And then it's just like, oh man, I've really fucked everything up here.
I've ruined everyone's life.
Everyone of my friends has now lost someone special. No, it's good, it's got a good sisters vibe, you know. It's it's not a brother's film, it's a sister's film, and that's, you know, that's nice. It's just good. Yeah. And it links to another film that we can talk about, which, you know, a much more established film. But, you know, it is just refreshing. It's just refreshing not to have just a bunch of dudes, you know, a bunch of white dudes as the protagonists. It just is. And that's not a kind of posturing like thing. It's just amazing how much more vibrant it felt just for being different, for having that. And then, as you say, the fact that it didn't then feel the need to start making lots and lots of big sweeping points and actually just be a good monster movie, even better, you know.
I really liked how it was directed as well. There's a certain sort of there's a kind of crude grandeur to the way that they filmed it. Like the use of drone shots over the city is actually really good.
Really good, yeah. Very much a lovely, like an open homage to Bernard Rose's Candyman. I mean, the opening, the shots, of Cabrini-Green above Cabrini-Green with Philip Glass's score were just being like openly sort of and lovingly kind of homaged, I felt, you know.
Absolutely, I would say The Grudge as well. The way The Grudge made the city that it was set in, which I think, I'm not sure where it's set actually, The Grudge, but the way it made that city feel like very sort of very wide, very sort of blank and concrete, and sort of like there was a lot of The Grudge in there as well. But it was great that it had such a sense of place. I mean,
it's the Gothic, right? So, you know, in Candyman, it is a Gothic. It's literally, you know, the trappings of a Gothic novel are being replicated in Candyman. And this does a similar thing where it kind of creates these large sort of looming spaces in which, you know, this kind of maelstrom of emotion and stuff is taking place. But it just repositions it really nicely. And as you say, there's something really terrifyingly blank and open about the spaces, which adds to the sort of danger. It doesn't go, it's not kind of dripping wet, shadowy, loom, you know, it's halogen lit, open spaces, deserted streets, abandoned tower blocks. It's really good. It's a great setting for it.
And it's, you end up with that similar feeling that you get you get in The Grudge as well, where the camera becomes kind of a malevolent presence. Mm. So the camera becomes the spirit.
Yes.
And it's just, and it's going over the city, and you're like, and it, you just get that feeling of like, okay, well, everyone's in danger, you know. And I really like the way that it's sort of, you just through using the camera, they kind of universalize how frightening Candisha is. But the other thing, it's got to be said about this film, is it's like, I think you can see where the money went, because some bits of this film definitely have more of it than others. There are definitely corners being cut, but I still think this is a really good film to watch. I think it does a lot of interesting, clever stuff. Like the scene where they sit down to sort of, by this point in the film, we realise there's basically a magician guy that knows what's going on and has all the books, and they sit round in a circle. And it basically turns into a sort of almost craft, almost Raiders of the Lost Ark style.
Yeah, and now it suddenly looks different, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's got a sort of almost, the Spielbergian sort of glow to it.
Which is great fun. Point, yeah. But they do this sort of seance, don't they, to sort of bring her to life. And it's all done with, like, you know, swirly cameras and sort of quick editing and stuff like that. But they do a really good job of it. I mean, I was watching it, and I think I was watching it with Lady and Nathan Savage, and I think we were both like, oh, okay, you can see the budget here. We were both like, this might look a bit cheap, actually. And then by the end of that sequence, we were both just like, that completely worked. I was just like completely nailed to my seat for it. Like, so these guys can obviously use a camera.
I agree. It reminds me of something like The Ritual, the David Bruckner film, where it's like he manages to take that, whatever the budget is, and just makes a film that looks great. So he finds an interesting, you know, in that he finds interesting ways to shoot the mundane, more sort of prosaic moments. And he also finds, you know, he uses drones and landscape shots to kind of create a sense of atmosphere, and then when it counts, it really has kind of like some good effect. And this is exactly the same. It really felt like a film. It didn't feel like a kind of low budget, you know, because there's a lot of these films out there which I do, some I dig, some I don't dig as much, but they ultimately, you know, they often rest upon a good idea, but then you start watching them, you're like, oh, I see, this is ultimately a two or three hander. There's only going to be three people in this. It's kind of set in one place, and we might get some moment of special effects, but not much. And so, you know, sometimes if the idea of the script or the acting is good enough, that's fine. But when it's not quite there, you're like, oh, this just isn't a satisfying cinematic experience, actually.
Yeah.
And what I liked about Candisha is it really looks, you know, like you say, whatever the budget is, they've really made it count. It looks great. It kind of feels like a movie. It has a texture of a film, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It has texture, full stop, you know? And I think the problem with a lot of those, the sort of films that you're talking about, I think what we decided, I think we're going to call them COVID era horror films, aren't
yeah.
we? Even though they're not actually made during that era, they perfectly encapsulate.
Yeah.
They don't really look like anything.
No.
You know, and I think there's a deliberate sort of indie blankness to the way, like one shot, two shot way that a lot of the sort of contemporary horror films are set out, because a lot of the time they are just two headers. It will just be a brother and a sister yelling at each other in a barn.
Yeah.
You know, or, like that seems
and then you realize that it's actually either the end of the universe or a million parallel realities existing at once. But the million parallel realities is all about brother and sister yelling at each other in a barn.
Oh, you've seen that one. Yeah.
Interference, it'll be
yes,
called.
Yeah, it will become something like that, yeah. you know, this film actually looked like something. It had a sort of energy and a crudeness to it. And a lot of that was down to the protagonists. But a lot of it was down to the fact that, yeah, like I said, I think these guys just really know how to move a camera around. And it's great to see that sort of level of, like, because, I mean, you know, they've made a few films now. They made another film called Livid, which I think apparently is really difficult to see, but a lot of people say is really underrated, so I'm going to try and find that.
Weinsteins have Weinsteined it, where they kind of optioned it for a remake, and then the remake's never happened, but it means that they, you know, part of the condition of that is that you can't see the original, blah, blah, blah. So, I'm sure it'll be available somewhere. This is a good one as well, because I think, you know, you might not, there's nothing particularly about like the cover or the title or anything that might make it leap out. but it's definitely worth a watch. Like, it's got a sort of fairly generic looking cover. There's nothing too sort of, but it's definitely worth the time.
You know, absolutely.
If you're into those sorts of, if you like anything we've said about it, definitely check it out.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's a good, really fun monster movie. And yeah, definitely recommend it.
So what was the, you said that there was another film.
Yeah.
It kind of, yeah.
So the film that I watched before we watched Candisha was Vampires versus the Bronx.
What's poppin'? Y'all, it's your girl Gloria coming at you live. If you see a kid that's riding a bike two sizes too big for him, that's his little man trying to save the neighborhood. And speaking of saving the neighborhood, what's up with all these missing person flyers?
Yo, check out the courthouse.
They're turning it into apartments?
Y'all know how this starts. Them white people with canvas bags, that's always the first sign.
What you doing down here, bro?
It's too late to fight back now. We are going to wipe you out like the vermin you are.
We got vampires in the Bronx.
Right, so Netflix film. Getting good reviews everywhere. Yeah, comedy, horror.
I've definitely hovered over it a couple of times, and yeah,
you know, and it's a horror comedy about a group of four kids in the Bronx who have to defend their neighborhood from vampires, and the reviews have been great, and the clever hook of it is that the vampires are basically meant to represent gentrification,
yeah,
and the kids are like hosting a block party to save their local bodega and stuff like that. This is Netflix's very much in the realm of Netflix have found Stranger Things to be a success. Therefore, Netflix knows that people like the 80s.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily going to make a film that is set in the 80s, but it's basically made an 80s movie. It's basically made The Monster Squad.
Yeah. But
it's got that kind of clever thing that you have to do nowadays where it's got its hook. So it's about gentrification in this case, you know. And it's an enjoyable film. It is. There's a lot that I liked about it. It's directed by a guy called Oz Rodriguez, who I think is a Saturday Night Live guy.
Okay.
And you know, it's competent and it's assured and it's likable, and our young leads are very capable, and it's funny, and it's utterly soulless. It was so weird watching it, but I think I'm beginning to sort of understand what a Netflix film is now. Like, there's been a lot of people talking about like the Netflix formula and stuff like that, and I'm like, well, yeah, but the films are all quite different. They're different genres and stuff. But it was watching this yesterday when I began to really sort of get a sense of, like, I think if you were to put one of their films on in front of me and not tell me that it was a Netflix film, I think now I'd be able to go, yeah, I reckon that's a Netflix film. I think I'm beginning to get the little giveaways and the little clues, like the lighting. There's a sort of softness to the way that Netflix films look, like quite sort of sodium lit, quite soft. Like, they all seem to have that. The shots are very sort of mid-range. You very rarely see any kind of like innovative camera work in a Netflix film.
Yeah, no one's strapping a camera to a board and throwing it around, or like you know, doing any Mean Streets Scorsese camera movements in these films. Yeah, no, they're very staid, aren't they? They've almost found a way. Like, after that, you know, the kind of Tony Scott hyperkinetic early to mid 2000s kind of like ridiculous sort of way of filmmaking that became just like has dated really badly, you know.
Yeah.
There was this kind of step back where everyone stopped moving the camera. Someone like Jeremy Saulnier is like a really good proponent of just going, let's just not be quite so hyperactive and yet somehow make all this kind of violence and tension count way more. But it's like a default thing now where people just don't move the camera. They just have lots of mid shots and lots of setup shots and long shots and, you know, small figures on a large landscape to kind of denote. Yeah, there's a real staidness now to kind of, yeah.
But a sort of like a real functionality. And there's a functionality to the script of this film as well. Like, it feels like the sort of quips seem almost maximally targeted to hit the right amount of people at the same time. And like, you know, a lot of the time, maybe that has something to do with the fact that it's being written by an SNL guy or comedian, but it feels more like a kind of management decision thing.
Yeah.
And it's like the really weird thing that I've started finding, particularly with these sort of Netflix, like more sort of youth orientated things, is like none of the characters are allowed to even entertain the idea of being mean to each other or nasty to each other. And it's so strange because you realize that, that there's a sort of subplot in this about, you know, one of the kids, it looks like he might end up joining a gang, you know, so far so rote. But it's like, it doesn't seem to result in any friction whatsoever between the characters. Mm. There's like a little bit of, oh, you said you wouldn't do that, and then you did, and then it's just resolved. And it's really weird because you just like, the film just ends up becoming a testament to these three boys and their great friendship.
Right.
And it's like, but without really testing the said great friendship or showing why it's important. And it was interesting. I was talking to the Duke Nutty and Savage about this, and he's big, big Trekkie, and he's been watching their, because Netflix have got Star Trek at the moment. They're doing the new series. And he's like, their Star Trek is exactly like that. Everyone has to end it as like best friends.
Mm.
There's like no friction between any of the characters whatsoever. And like, and that's something that I've started noticing in Netflix films. And it's like, that is so weird.
It is.
Like,
it's really,
it feels like cloying, and it really sticks in my throat. And it's just
I can't bear the kind of everyone's a good guy trope. So I was listening to someone talking about like Days Confused and saying like they were watching it with their kid, and their kid was just like, why is everyone being so mean to each other? And it's just like, oh no, that's just like what life was like. I'm not being like an old person saying this was, but as in like those kind of forms of like ritualized humiliation, bullying, you know, legitimized bullying, caste systems, people playing off against each other. It's like, you know, that was just like an accepted thing, and it was sanctioned by like society, full stop. Mm. And you know, that's not where we are now. And it's not to say, of course, that the stuff doesn't go on, but that's not where we are. And so some of this stuff now to like younger kids just looks like insane cruelty. And you just want to be like, no, like that's just kind of the rough edges of life, really, in a way. And you know,
The thing is, I agree, but it's like I say, it's like the problem with this stuff is it didn't feel like a vision. It felt mandated. Mm. It felt like someone had looked at the script and gone, no, you can't have that kid swearing at that kid. Get rid of that. Mm. No, you can't have them having a fight. Get rid of that. Mm. When the girl turns up, there has to be absolutely, because obviously the cool girl turns up at the end to help them in their quest to defeat the vampire.
Mm.
You know, like there can't be any friction about her being a girl and then being a boy. So it's just not remarked upon.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, that feels weird. Surely someone would say something. But
yeah,
it's just like,
so they are kids after all. You know, kids are really weird and like.
But and like I say, I wouldn't have a problem with this if I thought it was genuinely the voice of a generation that was speaking to me and move
rather
over.
Rather than, but
I don't think it is. It feels like Netflix are trying to avoid being sued by somebody. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you go to your local supermarket and they've just like, you know, they've just put up like a ridiculous amount of wet floor signs.
Yeah,
just like, yeah, but this clearly isn't wet. It's fine. It's just like, yeah, but if we don't put them all down, someone will fall over, you know.
And we will get sued. Yeah, well, you know, also there's that weird thing, you know, that the, like the new Ghostbusters film is now out and, you know, it's been traded a lot, you know, and it's this weird thing where, you know, it's got to be treated with this real reverence. And like, you know, like a special reconnect with the warmth of childhood thing. And it's like, that isn't what Ghostbusters was, though. That isn't what Ghostbusters was. It wasn't a warm, fuzzy childhood thing. It was actually, it kind of sat outside that sort of Spielbergian glowy, you know. And even the Spielberg stuff has a weird edge to it. It's not like all of that is actually, you know, saccharine. Part of, you know, one day I'll get to my big thesis about Spielberg and how, you know, he's a nihilist sentimentalist, and it's why his films are so incredibly successful, because those two things collide, you know, brilliantly. But, you know, Ghostbusters isn't that. And yet you just know that it isn't because this is what the kids want. It's because this is what some sort of corporate thing thinks the kids want. And oh, well, Stranger Things was a big success, so Ghostbusters needs to be more like Stranger Things. And it's like, but Stranger Things is like some weird secondhand experience of the 80s, which isn't really what the 80s was like. And actually, you know, so you just get this really weird sort of flattening of culture into just this, you know, like, as you say, everyone being friends, everything's about the magic of, you know, reconnecting with your inner child. Everything's about nostalgia. Everything's about people being nice. And there's just no sort of, like I say, no rough edges. And that makes for incredibly deadening art, you know, always.
Yeah. And you can feel the hot breath of the committee on it. And it's a shame because there's some really good gags in this film. Like, like some of the gags about gentrification are actually really funny. Like, you know, the local bodega they're trying to save with their block party has to start stocking ridiculous items for the new influx of white people.
Right, yeah.
So there's less.
It's got an incredibly good hook. That is a great idea, you know, and it's something that, you know, vampire films often do well, is they position the vampire as, you know, the newcomer, or, you know, or whatever. And it's like, there's something funny about that family. There's something funny about that person. And it's like, but it's a great idea. You can see how, like, literally you'd be like, pitch that, sold, done, done and dusted, you know.
But the way you feel the joke's landing is that it's almost like they have to have one every like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like, and here's another one of those. And here's, like I say, you could just feel the sort of the ticker tape going out of like, now it's time for a joke. Now it's time for, but my favourite joke in it, it must be said, is when they're down in the vampire's lair and they're following the vampire's footsteps and they're all pointy shoes. They're all just like really long pointy shoes that they're following with their flashlight. Which I thought was, very funny. But then when it actually comes to the actual vampire stuff, it just doesn't really do anything. It's sort of, they fight the vampires. Method Man turns up as a priest.
And you think, I mean, you know, again, on paper, you're selling this so well, but I know what you mean. It's almost like
Method Man's here. This is going to kick ass. And then he just doesn't do anything.
This is the problem as well. There's a lot of stuff now where it's like, it's almost like, we've nailed the high concept here. Let's take the rest of the day off.
Yeah.
We don't have to actually make the film because the high concept and, you know, the elevator pitch is so sweet. Hey, what about if Method Man turns up as a priest? Fucking high five, bro. Let's go to the bar. We don't need to finish that. We won't need to write that. It'll write itself.
Get in here. Get into this jacuzzi, you animal. Get in here, you madman.
You can just see that as well because it is just like, you know, like I say, that's a fantastic thing. Now, if Peter Jackson in 1991 or whatever had done that, then Method Man would have done some amazing shit.
the whole thing feels like curiously neutered. You know, it sort of turns into a straight up kids versus vampires film. And the thing is, I'm sure that, you know, obviously the Monster Squad is kind of your sort of prophetic ideal, isn't it, of that. But it doesn't have an ounce of the sort of imagination or the edge or the wit that Monster Squad does. It just has this thing where it just feels like it's ticking a bunch of boxes all the time.
Yeah, Monster Squad is like the latest film of which, it is being sort of recycled and rinsed and drawn from to increasingly like unsatisfactory ends, to the point where, you know, it'll start to impact on actually, like, people will be like, oh, I'm so sick of like that Monster Squad vibe. And it's a shame because it's a great little movie. Mm. And it's like, it was like the perfect thing to rent when you're like 12, which is kind of what it is. You know, it's not like, but it, as you say, it has this like wonderful kind of like slightly unsettling edge to it. Like, it's a bit too scary. It's a bit too horrible. The kids swear a bit too much, which makes it great, you know. And it's like, that's what's missing from these things. I mean, I think a more natural inheritor of it is Attack the Block. I think that's a great, you know, a great example of how, you know, you go, okay, so what about if a bunch of inner city kids were fighting an alien invasion? It's like, they're a bunch of little shits. And they remain little shits throughout, but they're also just kids, and you know, they're also mates and stuff, but I really like the way it plays up their little shit credentials fully.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I live in London. I routinely walk past groups of kids who are like that. And like, you know, I like that. I like the fact that it didn't sort of soften and go, yeah, they're all just actually wonderful. They're all just wonderful kids. It's like, no, they're just little shits, but they're also a bunch of mates. And that's got its own power. And then kind of welding that to a sort of John Carpenter siege is pretty cool, actually.
Attack the Block just stands up so well, and you can tell that this is a film. Attack the Block is a film that would have been focus grouped into any conversation that was had about when they're making Vampires versus the Bronx. You know,
absolutely.
But it is just they're looking at Attack the Block and they're going, let's just get rid of everything that makes this film interesting.
And it's like
now that I've seen that in the Netflix movies, I don't think I'm going to be able to stop seeing it.
Pitching stuff at the moment, I wonder how if people like play bingo for like every time or how quickly an executive says Stranger Things to you in a meeting when you're pitching anything. I bet it must be like if it's within the first 4 seconds you get like 100 points.
Yeah.
Have you seen Stranger Things? So
yes I have.
Could this be more Stranger Things? It could definitely be more Stranger Things. Make it more,
it's very possible.
I've already mocked up this font for the you know.
It's a classic example of font first filmmaking.
So I watched something. It's actually the second time I've watched this film, and I think you said you hadn't seen it, which is The Reef.
What happened?
Must have hit something. This boat's gonna sink. There's land over there, and that's where I think we should be going.
I fish these waters, mate. I know what's out there. I'm not getting in the water.
You're right about this.
You're not the only one.
Following us.
Izzy, you're freaking me out.
Oh, it's a shark.
How big? It's big.
Take some deep breaths with me.
So The Reef is an Australian nature survival film, I guess. It's by a director called Andrew Trocchi, and it was made in 2010, I think. And it's following like Open Water, which was the sort of the Blair Witch on water, you know, the kind of lo-fi handheld camera, you know, people literally just getting marooned at sea, incredibly realistic.
Marriage counselling with a shark.
Yeah, and incredibly like realistic. I remember like watching Open Water in the cinema, and just, you know, I have a deep and abiding shark terror, like a lot of people of my age, but it really is quite sort of deep for me. And I do love the sea as well. I'm not, you know, it's one of those things. I have a real sort of, I want to be in the sea, but it's just very scary to me, the thought of things beneath you that you can't see. So it works a treat on me, a shark exploitation movie, a genuine one, not this Sharknado bullshit. And Open Water it sort of set the template for this. Very successful. A lot of people disappointed because it's actually, you know, really quite realistic. It's sort of the sharks in it are just taking little chunks out of them. And when the sharks turn up, it's just like, oh no, now sharks are here. It's not good. But it spawned a few sort of imitators and films that sort of took it a bit more, you know, a bit more into the exploitation realms. There was a sequel to Open Water called Open Water 2 Overboard or something. And it's just like one of those things where it's just like, this isn't really a sequel, is it? This is another film. But,
from the Italian school.
The Reef looks really unpromising. It's got a sort of very generic, you know, cover, and it doesn't suggest that it's going to be anything. But this guy, Andrew Trocchi, made a croc-sploitation movie called Black Water, which is really good, about, you know, three people who take a trip out into the outback. But obviously chunks of the outback are just just water with like trees and stuff. So, but obviously there's tons of crocodiles. So they just, and they get marooned and then they get sort of trapped in a tree with a croc sort of hunting them. And it's good. It's a good stripped down little kind of movie that uses its budget well and is very tense. So, and this is like his kind of next film, which is, you know, a bunch of people go out on a boat. He specializes in very likable people as well. Like he really sort of tries to be like, yeah, they're just a bunch of okay people. They're not like super nice. They're just a bunch of mates. But, you know, no one's like a massive douche. No one's like fucking Superman. It's just like they're just a bunch of people. They go out on a boat. It kind of overturns and they're kind of adrift, basically. And they've got a guy with them who is their friend who's like good at nature, basically.
Right.
He's just like, they're like, well, look, let's just wait on the boat. They, you know, they're up, the boat's turned upside down. They're just like on the sort of bottom of it, you know. And they're basically like, well, let's just wait. You know, he's managed to secure the kind of the sort of alarm thing and they've released that and, you know, hopefully that someone will pick up. And he's just like, yeah, but we're drifting out to sea and no one really sort of goes here. So we'll be very lucky if someone goes over and hears this alarm. We're drifting out to sea. I know there's a kind of reef, you know, over there, but so far that you can't see it on the horizon. I think we need to swim to that because I think it's our best bet. And the friends are just like, no fucking way. And there's a kind of the guy who takes him out on the boat, who's a bit more of a kind of fishing guy, who's like chartered his boat. It's just like, listen, mate, I fish these waters. There's no fucking way I'm going out there, mate. You're on your own. I'm not doing that, you know. And so you get that kind of like, he's just like, no, there's bad things in that water.
Yeah.
And so the guy is just like trying to convince them. And basically, so you've got like one guy who's kind of good and, you know, the survivalist type, but a nice guy. He's nice. You like him. You root for him. And then you've got his girlfriend and their mates. So there's a sort of like ragtag bunch. And basically they set off with kind of essentially half a paddle between them. They've got one flipper on each like foot and stuff. They've got really like no supplies or anything like that. And he's got like a scuba mask. And then they just basically have to just swim out into kind of open water and just hope for the fucking best. And it is a really kind of effective little bit of sharksploitation because it plays up just like how little you would want to do that and how exposed they are, like how fucking exposed they are. And it's really kind of like, and then when inevitably they start to, you know, they notice that something's kind of around them and they're like, what's that? And he's like, I don't know. And he keeps looking under the water with his things.
Oh yeah.
Eventually, yeah. It's really good. there's one bit that's almost like transcends and goes into kind of like the kind of weird and eerie. There's like this one moment where they're swimming and the other guy can see something bobbing towards them. And he's just like, what's that? And the guy's like, just, I don't know, let's just ignore it. And it kind of gets nearer and nearer and he's sort of swimming towards it. And what you see is it's like a kind of turtle shell, like a giant turtle shell. But there's obviously like, it's just not alive. And basically he kind of swims over to it and it kind of, he nudges it and it's just like had a huge bite taken out of it.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Kind of rotting kind of turtle carcass. But it's really like, it's the only other thing they see. Yeah, everything else is just sea, and the only thing they see is just this. And it's really, I don't know why, but it really haunted me, like, watching it. I was like, that is a really nightmarish moment. And the whole film is kind of, you know, it's not perfect, but it's very good, and it's very, very much like, if you think that you would enjoy the feeling of just being, like, incredibly tense, you know, waiting for a shark to start fucking with people, and then it does start fucking with them.
Yeah.
It's good. It's quite bleak, you know. It's definitely one of those things where you are like, I like these people. Oh, that means I don't want to see them die. Oh, damn it, because they are going to have to die in order for this film to, like, you know, to justify its existence, really.
In order for my enjoyment to be complete, these men have to die.
It's really weird. Yeah, it's that weird thing of like, there's a sort of perfect note to hit of like, I do care about them, but I do want to see a shark getting people too. I actually really like it. I think you should check it out.
I will do. How are the sharks done? Are they CG or are they practical?
What they do is a lot of actual shark footage, but obviously cleverly cut so it looks like the shark's kind of nearer than it is and things like that. But it's a big, big fucking tiger shark. There's a great bit where they're like, is it a shark? And he's just like, it is a shark. Yes, yes. And it, like, what kind of shark? And he's like, it's a tiger shark. And you just know he's just like, oh, this is not a good shark either. Yeah. And then a couple of times they sort of, there's a bit of CG, but it's quite sparing and definitely we're not in deep blue sea territory, which is, you know, I like deep blue sea. I've got a lot of time for that film.
I think deep blue sea is at least partly successful because of the CG sharks, though.
Yeah.
I mean, whereas a more realistic approach can be kind of completely poleaxed by not particularly good
this,
CG
this
shark.
This film gets an awful lot of mileage out of just the sense of you being out of place, floating around in this ocean. Really, there's a lot of long shots of just nothing on the horizon,
cool.
And then the camera sort of just dipping below the surface, so you can see their silly little legs splashing around, and you're just like, oh god,
they're munchable little legs.
It's a very watchable movie. It's very, very. It's a good little exploitation. I think the Australians are really good at churning out these particular kinds of. You know, I'm a big sucker for, you know, some sort of sea. A water-based menace.
Yeah,
I like that, and I like films where people are kind of having to survive. I don't know whether it's just something that, you know, it's something that's kind of come out of the lockdown where I'm like, I don't actually want. I don't know. It's like I'm living. I quite like watching people in very like broad vistas getting hassled rather than being like. Trapped in small spaces.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It sounds a bit like, what's that the Fessenden film, is it Beneath?
Because that's on
Netflix at the moment. That's great. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's a great movie, and I have to say, like most Fessenden films, I watched that once and then watching it a second time really made me kind of appreciate it. Yeah, I think Beneath's great. It's Beneath is basically the Raft from Stephen King's Creepshow 2, well, the Stephen King story, The Raft. It's that, but done by someone who's a bit smarter and a bit like, you know, got a bit more to say about, you know. It's similar in the way that it has a sort of downbeat vibe to it, and it's genuinely quite tense. I think Beneath is a great film, though. I think Beneath has such an odd... the way it sort of starts to really just be like the menace in the Beneath is constant and around them, but really it's just when they just start fucking each other over on the boat. It's just like, oh, people are the worst.
Yeah, there's also that thing where it's obviously, you know, I can't imagine Fessenden going through school particularly unscathed, and it's just that thing of just like, it's all his least favourite kind of people from school in a boat together, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really good.
Because, yeah, it's free of the usual pontification of Fessenden and just feels a lot more like revenge from high school.
It's a really good film.
It's
a bit more like, for him, he was probably like, yeah, it's almost like a paycheck film that he's applied his usual kind of smarts to rather than a real passion project. But I rate it pretty high in the Fessenden canon, it's probably my second favorite after Last Winter, I think.
Yeah, I love the fish as well. I love the kind of evil fish puppet that follows it around. Yeah, it's so much fun.
Prehistoric blank-eyed thing that just keeps bobbing up from the surface. Yeah,
yeah. See, I'm with you. I like a good undersea horror. I like the next film that Bastillo and Mori, who did Candice, are doing is set in an underwater haunted house.
Okay.
So these people that kind of explore sunken cities, they go down to a sunken city and they find that one of the houses is haunted.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I like that. You've got one idea, you stack another idea on top of it, and then you just let it roll off. I'm really into that.
And you also go, this will be an absolute bastard to film.
Yes. Nobody had any fun making that film whatsoever.
there's that okay shark film, 47 meters down, which is sort of, it's okay actually. I mean, it's got some things I like about it, you know. Again, quite a good central idea. Doesn't quite launch it. The guy who makes it is just a bit of a chowderhead. He knows how to put a film together, but he's not.
Yeah,
he's not, doesn't feel like the smartest guy. And his sequel though is like, I think it's called 47 meters down, uncaged or whatever.
It's 47 meters down again. 48 meters down.
I think it was going to be called 48 meters down. Brilliant. But he set in a bunch of abandoned caves, underwater caves.
Right, because I read some reviews of this and I was like, I like the idea here, but have you seen it?
I watched it because of that. I thought, you know what? Like, the reviews are very snooty, but this is a solid idea. And I didn't hate the first one, but what it does is it's just full of like blurry, hard to see things happening with people with masks going, and then a shark kind of goes past them. And it tries to sort of play up the sort of claustrophobia of being in these undersea caves. Doesn't work at all because you've still got people underwater. So the whole thing just becomes incredibly, like, you know, just contrived, but also not thrilling or exciting.
Underwater films are really, really hard. I enjoyed that. What was the one with Kristen? What's her face for the Twilight films in it?
Oh, yeah, isn't it called Is that called Underwater?
I think it's called Underwater. Yeah,
Kristen Stewart.
Yeah,
yeah, who I really like actually.
Yeah, she's great, and I enjoyed that film I really, really enjoyed it, and I liked how ambitious it was. But like, there was, again, it had that problem of, as you so perfectly described it, people go through opaque masks, and it was just that thing where it's like, okay, I can't see anything.
Yeah,
like it became difficult to know where everybody was. But I do have enormous sympathies for people who are trying to make a film underwater because it just sounds like hell.
Yeah,
like, you read that, like the sort of the oral history of the abyss, I think it's up online, and it's just like, that just sounds like the most miserable experience that anyone involved has ever had, you know it sounds unfun.
I remember when I remember back in the day of the abyss, you know, it was only magazines and stuff where you could read about stuff, but I remember there were magazine articles routinely about what the hell is going on with this film.
Yeah,
you know, it's like James Cameron's been filming for 6 weeks underwater, and you know, like, it was just really reported, much like Titanic. Again, the same thing happened, but it was reported like, this is going to be a total shit show. And it, you know, the Abyss is a funny one. It's sort of dropped off the radar, but it's
you want to talk about James Cameron's least influential blockbuster, you know, like, that's a, you know, that is a difficult discussion. I would say the Abyss is probably up there.
I mean, this and probably Avatar.
Avatar, yeah. Avatar, the blockbuster that didn't make a sound.
everyone watched and went, oh, that was great, and then felt ashamed and decided they didn't want to think about it anymore.
So, no one, it has influenced nobody. It's really interesting, but I do have an enormous amount of sympathy for anyone who decides to film a film underwater. I am just like, fair play, mate. I'm glad I'm not anywhere near you. sounds horrible.
Because as I was talking about that 47 meters down uncaged and filming in caves, it did make me think of another film that we're going to talk about, actually, and a much more successful use of caves, which you were going to bring up, I think.
I was, yeah. So for the a couple of days ago, for the first time in quite a long time, I rewatched The Descent.
There's only one way out of this chamber, and that's down the pipe.
I'm stuck! I can't breathe!
Look, Sarah, you have to calm down. I'm coming back, okay? Okay.
Okay, move! Now!
This is not good, guys.
Get out of here! Which way?
I don't know.
someone. I saw someone.
No, you heard something and you saw what you wanted to see. It's the dark. It plays tricks on people.
So Lady Nuneaton Savage hadn't seen this, so I was like, right, okay, well, put down your phone, take your tea out of your mouth. That's what we're doing now. We're watching The Descent. And this film is deathless. Mm. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, I watched it basically because you said you'd watched it, and I'd seen it quite recently, but I just suddenly was like, oh, I want to watch it again too. Mm. And also I thought it would be interesting to see, you know, again, whether, yeah, it's great. It's such a good film.
A good film. It's like, this must be the, oh, I don't know. I mean, we must be getting on for double figures now with the amount of times I've seen the Descent. Mm. We must be. It was this time around, I did notice things that I hadn't noticed before. But basically, long story short, if you listen to this, you probably know what The Descent is. But a group of female cavers get trapped in a cave and get attacked by flesh-eating demons, flesh-eating troglodytes.
Cannibalistic troglodytes.
So we'll carry on. It was really interesting watching it now and seeing it in terms of, which I'd never thought of as before, but actually that there's a lot of genre pastiche in The Descent in a way that I hadn't really noticed it before. This was the first time I was watching it where I was like, oh shit, that's literally just from that.
Yes.
That's literally just from that.
Yes, yeah, it's literally it's just from that. To like, yeah, it's his love letter to like aliens and
yeah,
all these things, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, I'd never really thought of it in that way before. I've always just enjoyed it as a film in its own right. And it's only since, it's the first time I've watched it since we started doing this podcast. So obviously I've been watching a lot more films. And thinking about genre a lot more, but this was the only time I've seen it where I've been like able to point to literally everything that it's doing and kind of going, oh, it's completely just pastiche. But it's also the only time that I've seen it since that level of since Stranger Things, since that level of pastiche became almost de rigueur in horror films. So this predates that. And so when the last time I saw it, I perhaps didn't quite have the brain clicked in that was such a thing that it would be
more of an experiential thing, which I think you know it makes sense because The Descent is such a visceral experiential film. Like it takes you and it puts you in the space that these women are in, and if you're anything like me, it is horrid. I am a claustrophobic person, and I cannot think of anything less pleasurable to do with my time than going into caves under the ground. I wouldn't mind being in a big cavern, but if you are asking me to climb into a tiny little rock chimney where I'm not sure if it leads to anything, there are moments in this film that I literally have to pause, get up and kind of do a bit of a like, come on Dan, you can get through this. Like, there's the one bit in it where our protagonist, and it's before the monsters turn up, gets stuck, and they're in this really tiny little sort of funnel that they've got to get. It's one of the hardest sequences for me to watch at all of any film, really. I really cannot like bear it.
At the top of my arm there is a thumb bruise from Lady Nuneaton Savage in that scene where she just fucking grips me. Because then of course what happens is the tunnel starts fucking collapsing as well. Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that bit. Yeah. And I was like, oh yeah, it gets worse.
Yeah. It's one of the scariest moments in 21st century horror, as far as I'm concerned. It's so frightening.
You know, it's interesting with Marshall. He's had such a funny, like, and, you know, up and down career since then.
Oh, hasn't he ever?
And I think it's fair to say that The Descent is probably the last time that everybody just agreed and went, this is absolutely a classic. You know, there are fans for a number of his other films. There are certain films of his that no one is a fan of. Apart from maybe you. Yeah. But this is like a genuine, like, this belongs in the pantheon. It really does. And it's interesting what you were saying about the kind of the way it pastiches so many, you know, genre films, and, you know, it clearly has its eyes set on being part of this kind of lineage of incredibly good sort of exciting, tense genre film, stripped down, lean genre film. But it has this kind of, you know, classicism to it as well. It's not like stripped down. It's pre-found footage and it's pre-lo-fi filmmaking. So it's got kind of a stirring score and stuff, you know, much more akin to something like Aliens or I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's got this kind of, you know, there's a definite, this is more a Ridley Scott film than it is a kind of, I don't know, like a post sort of Blair Witch bit of filmmaking or something.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of what makes it so good, I think, actually.
Oh, I agree. It was just these little bits, like the first time I've ever noticed it, there's a bit where, you know, the two of the last people standing, it's, you know, it's beautifully shot. You know, they sort of emerge out of this cave and it's a really badass shot. And out of nowhere, a synthesizer just goes da-dung and just does a carpenter stab. And there's literally no other synthesizer in the entire soundtrack. No, it's all strings.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just that thing where it just goes da-dung. It's like, gotcha. Okay. Thanks, yeah. Neil. Cheers, mate. Nowhere here. But I've never noticed it before. But I think because now I'm just so much more hyper aware of that kind of genre pastiche. Because, to be honest, nowadays, it tends to get on my tits a little bit. It actually annoys me. And because a lot of the time, that very sort of box-ticking and da-dung-ing is all there is. It's all
exactly.
The film has.
And that's the thing, is that isn't... This is more like the way that someone like Joe Dante made really exciting films that as you get older you realize have loads of nods to things. I mean, you sort of pick it up as a kid, but you realize that he's continually nodding to, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, blah 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 blah, this is whatever, like Roger Corman thing, blah, blah. You know, he's doing it all over the block, but they're still really exciting films and they're really fun. And same with like Neil Marshall in The Descent. He's like, it is first and foremost just a really 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 exciting, lean, brilliant, like tense film. And then that stuff is just some stuff almost to please himself as well, to go, and also I'm going to nod to Carpenter and I'm going to nod to James Cameron here and stuff, but it's not like you say, oh, I'm just going to do a John Carpenter pastiche and hope that suffices, you know,
because that's the difference. It feels self-indulgent. It doesn't just feel indulgent. It feels like he's doing it to make himself chuckle, you know, and that actually, it gives the vibe of it. It makes the vibe a lot more bearable to me than somebody going, ah, 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 do you get it? And it's like, yeah, I get it. I really get it, you know,
I think it's interesting as well. I think, you know, Marshall's an interesting director in his kind of, you know, his approach to like masculinity and femininity and things like that, as in, you know, Dog Soldiers was his calling card. And, you know, it's, I need to watch Dog Soldiers again.
You
I
really do.
I do. But, you know, it's definitely got a sort of blokey, laddie sort of humour to it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you know, this was like post Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and, you know, very sort of that whole sort of geezer moment in pop culture, as a British pop culture. And I really liked the way that his next film, he was just like, yeah, it's just a bunch of women. It's essentially, instead of being a bunch of mercenaries like in Predator or whatever, it's just a bunch of fairly likable, normal, like women who are just, you know, extremely capable potholers, it turns out, you know.
Yeah.
and it's great because, just like I was saying with Candisha, it's incredibly refreshing to have just a bunch of women. And they're a really good bunch. I really, watching it this time, I really like her best friend.
Donna, I think her name is, with this sort of short black hair.
And she's I looked her up and she's been in a bunch of stuff since. She's just, you know, one of those people who's just in a bunch of stuff on telly and in films. But I really was struck. I was like, you are incredibly believable as like a good mate to a friend. And we have a little thing on the Savage Beast we like to talk about, which is arsehole of, you know, top arsehole of the Beast charts. And it, you know, we I think the last person to top it was the girl out of Psycho Goreman. Obviously
she was
the standard was set by the guy in the Stone Tape, but I think Juno in this film goes pretty high in the arsehole in the arsehole.
She is an
kind
absolute
of,
fucking bellend. Yeah. She is
there's
an absolute bellend.
There's one bit where she so but the main character, if you haven't seen it, well, you know, spoilers, etc. The main character loses her husband and child in the first few minutes of the film in a terrible traffic accident. So the whole thing is about her recovering from trauma, really, by going and getting, you know, getting out with her friends and going potholing, which is only crazy people would do that to get over trauma. But there you go. And what becomes apparent is that her friend Juno was having an affair with her husband. So that's the yes. double salt in the wound. And there's one bit where, like, Donna turns around and says, you know, essentially, like, hey, chill out. Remember, she lost her husband and child. And Juno says, we all lost people on that day. And I'm like, yeah, you lost the guy who you were shagging, your best friend's, like, husband. Like, and she looks really, like, you know, outraged. Like, we all lost someone that day. And I'm like, yeah, but I think you're a massive arsehole. And she just is a full-blown unapologetic arsehole and throughout but kind of that's kind of great as well,
yeah,
you know, because you've got to have a baddie, haven't you?
Yeah, and she's a cracking baddie. I really like
capable as well, which is good.
Yeah,
you know,
she sort of gets to have her sort of like heroic moments as well, which is really fun. But you're not left under any illusions the fact that, like, she's a dick. You know, and like the main reason that she's still alive is also because she's a dick. You know?
Yeah, the reason they're all fucked is because she's a dick, basically.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
She gets them into it. She kind of does the classic, oh, I didn't bring the guidebook.
Yeah. Yeah, she's basically everything that you suspect about those people that come into work wearing, like, those really sort of, like, expensive-looking leggings that go, like, climbing at the weekend. You're always like, I bet they're wankers, actually. I bet if they can survive and do more like climbing with bats in the Andes, but to survive they had to push you off a cliff, they'd do it, wouldn't they?
Do you know what I mean?
It's like I've always been highly suspicious of people that will wear clothes that look like that. I don't care how practical they are, but she's an atrocious human being, and I think the film is all the stronger for having her in it. I think she's terrific.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's a really good. It's got a really good, fresh. It's remarkably fresh seeming, considering it's 15 years old. Actually, you know, it's and part of that is because it's not so time locked. It does aspire for a certain kind of, like I say, I guess classicism is the word, but it isn't. Particularly wed to a moment, you know, it could be happening now, you know?
Yeah, and it's really sort of classically directed as well. You know, that's the thing with Marshall. I don't think anyone would ever say that he was like a particularly stylistically innovative or avant-garde director, but he could just film the shit out of stuff. He just knows where to put a camera.
He knows where to put a camera and he knows how to stage kind of action and tension sequences. So, like, because you think, oh, you know, but surely, I mean, you know, just put some people in a cave. And it's like, first of all, that's really hard. I mean, it is, a lot of it's obviously sets and stuff like that. But first of all, you don't notice that they're sets, which is great.
Not at all.
It's incredibly, you really believe you're there. But also, actually, you realise the way he kind of cuts stuff together, the way he films, the way he positions things, you know, you never get into that. You know, there's lots of darkness in this film and lots of stuff happening by torchlight. And it never devolves into just you going, what's going on? I can't see what's happening. You do have a clear idea of where they are, the sense of space, the sense of location and it, you know, that is a real skill, and he's got it. He's got it in spades. It's just his attention to strange subjects. You know, on a technical basis, he's a great filmmaker.
It's so clever what he does with the light in this film. Like when the girls split up, he gives them different coloured. You know, those like torch things that you crack and they light. He gives them different coloured one of those, so you can tell who you're looking at.
Yeah,
it's just like little things like It's just little things like that where you're like, why don't more directors think to do stuff like that? It just makes the whole thing more bearable. And so this is the thing, because I have iron in the fire here, because I have this real crush on Saskia Mulder, who's the sort of taller Swedish lady.
She's the other sort of super capable one, isn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah, and she used to be in a long forgotten BBC sitcom called Trevor's World of Sport, which is like generally regarded as one of the great lost BBC sitcoms. And she was hilarious in that and really hot. And I got very upset when she got eaten.
Yeah,
and I do every time.
It's what we were saying as well about that, you know, I was saying about the Reef is that it's that thing where you do actually quite like people, and then you're like, oh, yeah. I really want to see you get eaten. I mean, you don't mind when the like gobby Northern Irish one goes, because she's kind of a dick as well.
Yeah, she's annoying.
She's the one who keeps leaping, like, I'm going to go up this tiny little. I think basically she's probably not a dick. It's just I could not understand her mentality.
Yeah.
Because the idea of like being like, I want to be first into the tiny rock envelope.
That's why you're dead.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, like, it really, I mean, it did a number on me, actually. Again, just watching it, it's just like, this is like incredibly you know, it's really interesting to watch a film and have that kind of visceral, like, oh Jesus Christ, no.
Yeah,
because it doesn't happen very often, and it's really exciting when it does. You know,
when the combination of the environment and the peril, because it gives it that disaster movie sort of feel as well, doesn't it? Where you're just kind of like, what's going to happen next? You know, like,
for a good, you know, over half of the film, it is just a disaster film. That's what's it's a survival / disaster film, and that's what's great. And it's testament to it that I was watching it again and I almost had been like, oh yeah, of course. I forgot the whole monsters bit. And that's how kind of compelling and absorbing it is that, you know, you get in straight back into like the just surviving moment to moment. And
It's a real shame though, that it is one of those films that, like, maybe because of when it came out, like if you look at reviews for it online, there is this huge amount of, it's a fantastic little survival thriller. I don't know why he had to put a bunch of monsters in it, because it's just not as scary. It's like, because that's when it becomes an action movie, you fucking prick.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You patronising douchebag.
Yeah.
Like, because if you didn't, you'd have got bored. You know? Yeah. It just that kind of criticism annoys me so much. But it's like the way that it ramps from survival movie to horror movie to action movie is action so movie. Capably handled. It's so well done that you just don't notice the joins. And it's the first time you see the monsters, the first time they attack, is still just such, when the camera just swings past and you just sort of see them, it's still such a kind of like heart in mouth moment, because I'm never prepared for it. I'm never ready for when it happens. You know?
No. Yeah, yeah. I loved it, actually. I have to say, I really did. And it was one of those films that I remember sort of wondering if it would hold up. You know, when after seeing it and really liking it when it came out, and then just thought, I wonder if it was as good, because there's definitely times where you kind of really get something. For me, I remember like having that with Cabin Fever. I thought Cabin Fever was great, Eli Roth's Cabin Fever, because I was at the Edinburgh, I was working in Edinburgh for the festival, and the film festival was on, and I went to see it, and so I was like, oh, as a byproduct of working here, I get to go and see all these films. I've never been to a film festival before, this is great. And I remember like reading a review of it, and it was basically just like, this is like the new Evil Dead. And I was like, cool, went to see it, had a lovely time, ended up chatting to this Canadian dude like afterwards, and we went for some beers. It was just like, yeah, we love this film. And I really was convinced that Cabin Fever was like a really great sort of Raimi-esque knockabout, great sort of slice of comedy horror. And then I tried to watch it the other day and was like, oh, this is just a pile of shit. It's dreadful.
It's like, bizarre that film was ever considered watchable in the first place. It's so strange looking at that film now.
Yeah, and it's just really odd. Like, it's got, it's just aged incredibly badly. But it's also just that it's just literally a bunch of stuff stuck together with sellotape. Oh, I want a bit of this in there, I want a bit of that in there, and I want to do this. You know, it's kind of like, you can really see this sort of trauma school of, you know, James Gunn has similar thing going on, actually, where you can see he's just like, I want to have that, and I want to have this, and I want that. I think Gunn's probably a better filmmaker.
I think a much better filmmaker, yeah.
But yeah, no, it was just one of those things where I remember just being really convinced it was great and then telling people it was great, probably recommending it to lots of people and all that stuff. And it was definitely like a moment of like, you saw it in a specific way and you really liked it and you really wanted it to be a lot better than it was and you had fun and then you came away and then it's like you went back to it and it was not a good thing.
It is. It's funny how film festivals can do that.
Yes.
It's funny how the convivial attitude and cheap drinks of a film festival can make you like films an awful lot better than you thought.
You see it sometimes, don't you? You see it, like, they get reviewed in, like, you know, The Guardian or, like, AV Club and stuff, and people just be like, yeah, this is an A-plus film. And then by the time it actually makes its way to its cinematic release, it's down to, like, easily a C.
Oh, so someone had stocked up on the free cheeses in the board outside the screening.
And oddly, actually, sometimes the ones that get like really ripped to shit and booed and like ignored and stuff tend to be the ones that obviously are more interesting, you know, have something either more polarizing or just more kind of have something going on. So.
Yeah, the classic example is always Fire Walk With Me, isn't it? Which was like torn to pieces when it played at Cannes. And I think nowadays a lot of people would say is actually David Lynch's best film, you know.
I mean,
I think a lot of the same people that booed it.
Definitely.
Yeah,
I would agree. Yeah, sure.
It's interesting. The festival experience, sadly, is not necessarily the best. It's the same with bands. It's not necessarily the best way to judge a band if you're watching them at a festival. Mm. You know, it's like the air of conviviality means that there's often a less than honest appraisal going on, I find.
I really like that band. Why did you like them? Because I was lying on my back smoking a spliff in the sun. That's what I
Yeah, I would have enjoyed a speech from the leader of the Man Boy Love Association under those circumstances.
I'm trying to think of a smart segue out of that.
I can. So, unsegueable.
What are we going to talk about next?
Well, I think you wanted to talk about a wolf guy. その男ならここにいるぜ。 見ろ、 これが幹の呪いだ。 次はお前か。 お前か。
恨みが現実に人を殺すか。よ、ミキのこと聞きてんだよ。お前ミキのこと知ってんだろ。 あんたの悪事、あんたを動かしてるどっかの偉い人のこと俺のここに全部入ってる。何のことだかさっぱりわからんね。じゃあ吐き出してもらうまでだよ。
Wolf guy.
Tell me about this guy who's a wolf.
So I this was on Arrow and was on there as a Sonny Chiba tribute, I think.
Right, yes.
They've got a little Sonny Chiba kind of tribute section up there.
As is only right and proper.
Is entirely correct. And I've seen the poster for Wolf Guy a few times and just gone, okay, I mean, that's a great title. I want to see what Wolf Guy is. And I stuck this on Saturday night. I'd had a few. And for at least half of this film, I was convinced it was the greatest film I'd ever seen in my life. And I believe I was texting you to that.
You were, to that effect.
And I stand by that. And the only thing that stops it being like 100% the greatest film is just because it does that amazing thing that that like Japanese exploitation films do, which is they go, I'm going here now. And you go, are you? And it's completely, you know, like quite a lot of Korean films do that as well. They really just like fit in so many different like genres and tonal shifts that you can feel like whiplash watching them. I'm like, hold on, is this a slapstick broad family comedy or is it a monster movie? It's like, yes, it's all of those things. And now yeah. it's like a heartbreaking depiction of, you know, post-war, blah, blah, blah. You know, they just have that real sort of free and easy way of just kind of mashing this together. And so Japanese exploitation films have this kind of incredible ability to just zag in a way that you're like, what the heck? But this, I think I described it as a psychedelic kung fu werewolf cop film.
Yeah.
Urban werewolf cop film. And it kind of is that for the first half. And then in the second half, it goes into something completely different. And it's apparently, it is based upon a manga, which does explain it. So it does feel, watching that, once I had that knowledge, I was like, oh, I see, this is probably like volume three.
Yeah.
So this whole first section is probably just like one volume of it. But it creates an incredible sense of like, hold on a minute. But it's one of those things where you start off in one place and by the end of the film, you just cannot believe where you've ended up. But mm-hmm. it's directed by Kazuhiko Yamaguchi. And it's at 1975. The subtitle is Enraged Lycanthrope. Wolf Guy, Enraged Lycanthrope. so that's good. And I actually, watching it, assumed that Sonny Chiba was a cop, but he's not. He's a crime reporter, I think, it turns right. out. And... He's kind of like, well, classic
Japanese exploitation protagonist, white collar job as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like crime reporter, person who works in office.
Don't recall him reporting much crime in this.
Yeah.
But he basically gets on the trail of this this story because a bunch of this kind of rock band called the Mobs are getting killed one by one. In plain sight, being torn apart effectively in plain sight in the middle of the street. So like
wow.
it opens with this guy like barging through the street, like being pursued by an invisible something or other. And it's all kind of like on the streets of like Tokyo. It's like very verite, very kind of instant, like pounding psychedelic kind of, I mean, when I say this is your kind of film, it's 100% your kind of film. Great soundtrack, real good right. psych soundtrack. And he then gets like literally like brutally torn apart in front of our protagonist, who then is kind of like, right, I've got to find out what's going on. It turns out that they have, and this is where the film sort of takes a slide into, you know, more sort of darker exploitation realms. And it becomes, you know, like it's kind of like a sort of, I think they used to call them like roughies or whatever, where it's kind of like there's a bit of like women being roughed up.
Stuff, yeah.
You know, so it's a bit like, yeah, OK, this is kind of, but, you know, it, true to its kind of its genre exploitation, you know, heart. It is that. But it turns out this singer was kind of like gang raped by them and ended up getting syphilis. This is dwelt upon at length in the, there's a lot of discussion yeah. About this in the you know, the shame of it and the kind of thing. It's interesting. The film has that weird thing, like some of the other, you know, the kind of prison movies and stuff like that, where it's both an exploitation film and seems to be quite a condemnation of like the misogyny of like Japanese culture. It would be a stretch to call it in any way a feminist film, but it definitely feels like it's not just a misogynist film. Basically, there's yeah. more going on there. It's just that it's a very much an exploitation film. But anyway, this has unleashed some sort of latent psychic power in her, the power of the tiger, and she manifests this kind of psychic tiger which tears these people apart. But it just is literally. Like a superimposed tiger just kind of appears on the screen, like, and then people just get torn apart. But I mean,
that sounds fucking amazing.
The thing about it is, it's not roaring or leaping, it's just standing as though in a zoo.
But the thing is, I love that because I love that, like, that really kind of Japanese combination of like stillness, like design and pictures. Like, it's one of the best things they do is, like, you know, sudden shots of something still and a sudden crackle of like electronic score. You know, that's such a big part of their filmmaking. And I love that stuff. It hits me right in the heart.
And sounds incredible, this film. Yeah. Like, I just was, my heart was in my mouth. I was like, this is such a good film. And it's so weird and it's so odd, the sort of jumps and shifts. There's like one bit where she's supposed to be kind of like playing at this erotic kind of dancing club, you know, strip club effectively, where, like, you know, and she just sings this like weird deathly kind of condemnation of men and just lies down in the middle of the stage while everyone boos her and like literally throws stuff at her, and she just lies there and it's really like, this is amazing. This is like a really amazing moment. And it's just packed full of that. And you think to yourself, okay, I've got the measure of this. This is kind of like, you know, but then it turns out that this guy, Sonny Chiba's character, is actually the last in a long line, a tribe of wolf people who are kind of exterminated in some weird sort of governmental cull. And then he goes on the run, and then he's being pursued by this kind of guy from like the Japanese CIA, and suddenly it's like a kind of in the wilderness like pursuit film, and it's still linked to this kind of psychic tiger woman, and then he meets his own mother who's also his lover. This is what I mean, is like, you think you've got the measure of it, you think, oh, this is like an urban kind of weird sort of, it's a bit like an episode of The Night Stalker or something, you know, like a kind of, and then it just isn't. I mean, it's just fucking weird, and it's just got amazing stunts in it. The only thing is, some of the fights, considering Sonny Chiba is like, you know, his whole thing was this street fighter kind of technique, and it's, you know, like real sort of brutal scrapping form of martial arts. But some of the fights aren't filmed as well as they sometimes are in these things. It's like the director doesn't quite nail some of the fights. I think you kind of want to see Sonny Chiba do his thing a bit more clearly, but it's good when it happens. It is quite brutal, and he does you know, beats people up, and it is, it's gory, it's weird, it's got an amazing soundtrack, and it is just like, by the end you're like, hold on a minute, when you actually start to think back where it began. But yeah, you got to check it out. You definitely will like it.
It's been on my radar. Like, Shudder had it for quite a long time. It's been on my radar for quite a long time, and it it just shows up to the fact that, like, I just don't know enough about Japanese cinema from that period.
No, me neither. I feel like a real neophyte, actually.
Yeah, when you start getting to these sort of the 80s, when you start getting to like Tetsuo and films like Burst City and, you know, Tokyo Fist. And any Sakamoto. I mean, we'll talk about Sakamoto soon. But the sort of 70s and 60s stuff, particularly the sort of 60s stuff, there's a sort of there's a kind of a wackiness to some of it that I find a little bit difficult sometimes. It's very sort of like their sort of absorption of things like American beach movies. You know, the sort of like real sort of like pre-Elvis teenage beach movies.
Yeah, those Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon style.
Right, yeah. You know. Like the Japanese, a lot of the sort of 60s Japanese cinema seems to be quite into that sort of thing. And
yes,
I think I'm pretty sure that a lot of it is very much pastiche, because, you know, a lot of Japanese stuff, there is this kind of like sort of sending it up quality. But it's sometimes I find it a bit off-putting. So I think a lot of the sort of 70s stuff, and also the kind of like the sort of the whole martial arts movie glut that we grew up during, you know, the sort of Asian martial arts movie glut, where it was like, it was the coolest thing in the world to like sort of martial arts films from Japan and from China and from, you know,
And
it just became a bit tiresome.
There was a sort of artless, unfiltered quality, a bit like when manga, the label in Britain, there was like a sort of British licensing of Japanese anime. And it was just called manga, the label. And they brought out Akira. That was their first release. And obviously it was Akira. And then they just sort of repackaged loads of things like weird, like Dominion Tank Police episodes of that. And And it all just, but it was all a bit like, it wasn't quite as curated as it might have been. So it was just after a while, you're like, what is this? You know, you'd get something and there wouldn't be enough context to understand that this was actually part three of a 28 part long running series. And it was presented as though it was a film, and it just, you just ended up judging it quite harshly, going, well, what is 3x3 hours? This is just garbage. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I mean, you're just literally watching a couple of episodes of it, you know,
that, or something that had been like mashed together out of like 20 yeah. episodes into an hour and a half, and like really badly dubbed.
Yeah.
And like, and
or it's just like, something like Urutsuki Doji, which is just genuinely fucked up.
I'm not going to make you watch it, but one day maybe I'll just do like a little side episode about Urutsuki Doji, because I have thoughts about that film. It won't surprise
me. I actually do want to watch it again.
It's way more interesting than people tend to remember it being. It's just vile. But yeah, it was interesting. But I think that sort of put me off a lot of Japanese cinema, was my own sort of cultural hang-ups about like the sort of people who were into it. And they sort of wore expensive trainers and brown trousers and little baseball caps. They were just quite annoying. Yeah, yeah. You know, they were just a bit annoying.
I think what I'm finding when I'm watching stuff, because I've watched, and I think we almost need to do an episode about the series or something, but the Female Prisoner 701, Scorpion, Jailhouse 41, all that, you know, the sequence of films, which are the kind of, again, like female prison exploitation movies. Some of that stuff is hard to watch, but they are also so badass and so incredible, and just they look great. They've just got this real gnarliness. They're sort of effortlessly cool. There is a real sort of, I can see that there is this thing where it's just like Quentin Tarantino wishes that he could have pulled off any of this stuff in Kill Bill, you know. And I don't think, again, you know, it's not to return to Tarantino. He's not without his merits, and Kill Bill is almost as a primer of other things to go to. It's got its value and stuff, but there's something so lumpen and wooden about his staging of stuff that when you watch these kind of 70s, pretty like harsh exploitation, Japanese exploitation movies, you're like, they are just way fucking cooler. They are so much cooler. Like, you know, like I say, just the soundtrack on Wolf Guy is just so good. And like, you're just like, this is great. It looks amazing. It's like the early parts of it literally look like Mean Streets with a kind of weird, like crossed with a kind of Hammer film or something. It's just, it's great, you know.
But this is what I've always thought of as like one of the greatest failings of Tarantino. And I think you've just put a nail in it when you just said about the soundtrack there. It's like, what kind of filmmaker is a filmmaker who just uses other people's soundtracks? Soundtracks that have already been done. Do you know what I mean? There's something about the practice of that where it's either other people's songs or bits of other people's soundtracks. There's something about the practice of that where I'm like, there is something genuinely creatively bankrupt about that decision. Like genuinely, like that's not an inspiring pastiche or an interesting thing to do. It's just like, a bit cheap, you know. Well, and it bothers me when he does it, like
belays the ultimate sort of like fan/collector rather than creative, actually. I feel like it ultimately is just like him just trying to let you, to remind you of something else, or to make you notice the needle drop in a really kind of like, but ultimately it's weird. It's like there is only, the only purpose that has is just to draw attention to the sort of artificiality and the sort of collage, gotta collect them all mentality that drives a lot of his impulses, it seems. I don't know. Yeah, it's a sort of ultimate postmodern failing, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, ah, yes. You see what I'm doing? It's like, yeah, and it's not very good.
It's made you look cheap. You know, I don't know what it is about using, you know, he borrows everything else, but I don't know what it is about using just soundtracks from other people's films that he does that bothers me. But there's something about it. But it's like, then you do look at something like Wolf Guy, and when the decisions are the sort of quantity level brains in overdrive, you know, that sort of, just when the brains are just everything's firing, it's just, we've just got to keep moving no matter what the cost. And it's like, Quentin Tarantino will never make a film where everything's firing and things just have to keep moving no matter what the cost. Mm. He doesn't have that kind of brain. He doesn't operate in that kind of system. And as a result, what you get is a sort of very expensive impression of a fast moving film. You know,
well, this is the thing film. Is like, I think that there seems to still be no decent critical appraisal of him that just sort of goes, you know, these films are so stodgy and so, like, you know, there are ones I love that where the sort of slowness is almost like a benefit, you know, like I think Pulp Fiction has this leisurely quality that works, and I think Inglourious Basterds works as well, because there's something about the scale, the widescreen scale of it, the sort of, I don't know what it is, it just sort of works.
Yeah.
But it is like, they're just so stodgy and sort of slow, and like, you know, scenes just drag on sometimes. And this, for someone who's apparently known for this crisp dialogue, sometimes you're like, this is painful, this dialogue.
Yeah.
It's sort of long and awkward and doesn't feel like anything that, you know, anyone's ever said in their life. And that's not, that doesn't have to be the, fakeness is not a problem, but it's just so, you know, compared to someone like De Palma, who just cracks along in his crazy sort of cut and paste collage ways, you know.
I don't think it's just that thing where it's like, it's not necessarily about sort of fakeness or authenticity. I think what's interesting to me is like with him, it's like, you know, to sort of think about him in terms of exploitation cinema as well, is like, there are lots of like exploitation films that are fucking ridiculously slow feeling, or will suddenly just stop and have two people talking to each other in a room for a really long time. And it's like, and I can see that, you know, I enjoy those scenes, and I bet he does as well, but you can't really try and sort of write your way out of them as almost like a puzzle or something like that. It's like he puts them in his film and it slows his films down. And I really do. I think he is pretty much the architect of the world we see around us. He is the great cultural architect of the world we live in now. I don't think there can be any denying that. I also think it highly likely that future generations are going to look at his films and just be like, what the fuck was everybody thinking?
They are basically
hype capitalist hyper bloats. You know, and it's the shit. It's just pop culture and indulgence and feeling good, or, you know, being slightly shocked. You know, it's just this sort of like tick list of like the things that we require from our art these days. And he was the first to really give it to us. But I think as a result, future generations are going to be like, as he defined this age, so I think he'll also serve to be a bit like its capstone in some respects.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good shout, because sometimes there is just there's an almost like snow blindness that I realize I have, where I can't actually see them as anything. I'm so sort of caught up in the myth of him, and in the kind of iconography of him as you know, this name, this person, this explosion onto kind of cinema. You know, the impact of him was extraordinary. And it's kind of hard to almost quite understand. Yeah, like it is just clearly like a moment of like ultimate sort of zeitgeist collision of, you know, the person and the moment and stuff. But it does mean that, you know, I do still have this weird like, the latest film by Quentin Tarantino, a real event. And, you know, it's like, is it an event? I don't know. And it's like, maybe it's just because they are like, there are no other films like these, for better or worse, you know. I don't know what it is. It's really hard, but it's almost like I can't see it in a proper, like you say, like a removed way, where you just go back and go, wait a minute, hold on, I think, you know.
It's that thing where you get to have a film that isn't a franchise film. And though, bearing in mind, this dates to before Marvel movies became a thing, you know, where it was a original filmmaker whose films were an event. Everyone talked about them. Your mum would watch them eventually, you know, but everyone would watch them. And that's something that's kind of ossified. I mean, what's his name? The guy that does Royal Tenenbaums and all that him.
Wes Anderson.
Wes Anderson. Like, he's like pretty much the only person that's come up since that I'd say when their films come out, it feels a bit like an event. But even that's on like a much smaller level than Tarantino.
Yeah, and his impact is really just that he's influenced a whole slew of like M&S adverts and things like that. You know?
Right, but like, and Paul Thomas Anderson maybe as well. But
Thomas Anderson is actually, it's not really an event. It's just for cineasts.
Yeah.
I actually sort of think your average person, if you went, have you seen The Master? They'd be like, no, what's The Master?
Yeah.
Or have you seen Inherent Vice? You know, they might remember Magnolia and they definitely remember Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like, and they might, There Will Be Blood was probably the last one where it's like, this is, but even then I feel like, and you know, I love some of these movies a great deal, but I feel like he is the real, the people who talk about films a lot, they are like, he's their guy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Tarantino is more like, he's actually the Saturday night, you know, movie going crowd.
Exactly. You
know, the Coen brothers are probably the only other people who have a bit of that kind of,
yeah.
But there's something so inherently like hermetically perfect and oddly just like distant about the Coen brothers films. It's just more like they just beam in and go, here is the new Coen brothers film. It's perfect, isn't it? You go, it is perfect. And they're like, see you later. We'll be back in 2 years. Yeah. It's just like, you know, they are like really hard. Again, they're really hard to sort of understand, but I don't think that people will look, unkindly, and you know, future generations will not look unkindly at the Coen brothers films. They'll just do what everyone does, which is go, these are very good, aren't they?
Yeah.
Wow, this is a good thing. Gosh, it's like perhaps a little bit impersonal, but very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you have to wonder. But I think Tarantino will be crucified, will be consigned to the dustbin along with all our generation's indulgences.
Just along with our generation,
yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, you've got to hope.
So have you got anything else that you want to just...
I've been rewatching Star Trek The Next Generation.
Am I late? Did I miss the fight? En garde!
You, sir, you have a familiar bearing. Is it possible our swords have crossed somewhere before?
Where is he? Where's Barclay?
Ah, a personal grudge. I warn you, it would be wise for you to put your affairs in final order before you meet him in combat. You challenge the greatest sword
in all the holodeck. You think this is funny?
You are very tall. It might be threatening to some people.
Mr. Barclay will find out what it means to be threatened. Computer, discontinue image of Riker.
Sir, you have no sense of fair play.
Just tell us where to find Barclay.
It's, do you know what? You know, just so we can just end this on a high, it's been so much fun rewatching it, because all the ones that you remember from watching, because, like, you know, we're about the same age, so this started in 1986. So I remember watching the first episode.
It really was that old, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember watching the first episode in the common room, the teacher's common room of my primary school, while my mum did a parents' evening.
Oh,
I have a vivid sense
that
memory.
That is vivid, yeah. Yeah.
And I would have been like six or seven. And re-watching it and seeing it like just in big chunks, and seeing it grow, and seeing its strengths and seeing its failings. And its failings are abyssal at points. Like, it is, it's a stunningly unsubtle piece of television. It has points. It makes many points. It fires them at you like something out of a tennis server. Like, it's just like,
yeah, yeah.
Subtlety does not exist in the world of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Certainly not allowed in genre film, genre entertainment. It's like, no, you must make your point very heavily.
And it's like, to a point that, like, when you watch it now, and, you know, stuff could be unsubtle, as we've discussed earlier, but it is like, it's still quite shocking how little subtext there is in Star Trek The Next Generation. But the ones that you remember, which is the holodeck episodes, the episodes where Q turns up and starts fucking with the fabric of reality, those are absolutely the best ones. Like, Whenever they're trapped in a holodeck malfunction, and you read reviews on that, like, I've started keeping up because I'm reading the blogs as well, so, you know, as I go along, because, you know, that's the kind of thing I like to do. And it's every time they're like, yeah, guys, I know, another holodeck episode, right? This is going to suck. It's like, no, this time Captain Picard gets to dress as Robin Hood and all the rest of the crew is merry men.
Featuring. That's the only ones I remember.
Yeah.
The only ones I ever remember was like, oh, they're all in 1920s Chicago.
Yeah.
Captain Picard. And Riker is a bootlegger, obviously. Yeah.
No, the Robin Hood one features my all-time favourite Star Trek line, which is when Worf, who has become Little John, goes, "Sir, I protest. I am not a merry man."
I remember that.
And yeah,
can we just watch it?
And like, those are absolutely the best ones. But then, like, they will, like, there'll be a little sweet spot where they'll just do exactly the same as what the first series, the original series, feels like. There'll just be one where you're like, that is an idea and an execution that could have come straight out of a really gripping sci-fi, little sci-fi paperback.
Mm.
You know, just a single idea about a civilization that no one's met before.
Where
you're
like an Alfred Bester short story or something.
And it would occasionally just hit that little sweet note. And because of the charisma of the cast, because it's a fantastic cast, they're not all the best actors in the world, but together they are a fantastic cast.
Good, yeah, it's a good ensemble, yeah.
Together with that, it really carries the good stuff. It really goes over the finish line. And it's really enjoyable to be sitting down and watching a science fiction program that isn't like either blasting me with like buzzing strings the entire time, like the sort of BBC Doctor Who thing where there constantly has to be a soundtrack of strings going digga digga da digga digga da over absolutely everything. That's like slower and it, but also isn't like a sort of cute, like almost kids cartoon sort of style kind of vibe. It's just like or
Black Mirror.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, and I haven't
feel bad sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh.
But to actually like watch something that's really optimistic and funny and like occasionally just really stupid.
Mm.
It's just been a joy. It's really, really fun. And the thing of being a bit older and watching it is you get to really get to know the characters properly. Because like when you're a kid, you're not really paying much attention. You know, you know who Worf is, but like you don't realise that until you watch it when you're older that Worf is basically completely useless. Because he's a person who's based on war, and the whole Starship Enterprise thing is that they don't do war.
So it's
like every time they're just kind of like, Worf, have you got any ideas? He goes, I think we should bomb them. And then everyone goes, no, Worf, that's stupid. What are you talking about? We're not going to do that with the Starship fucking Enterprise. And you can just see Worf go, why the fuck am I on this show?
Yeah. Worf's basically just looking over and being like, oh, I see the counsellor is on the deck again.
Yeah.
Right, so she's got equal weighting.
Yeah. Deanna Troi is about to cock block me from bombing a fucking bunch of Romulans.
I just like the idea of like, it's a bit like he looks around and there's Deanna Troi and he looks over there and there's the woman from HR on the other side is also there. Like, I've got my eye on you.
Yeah.
Right, you know. Workplace harassment.
Or Guinan, played by Whoopi Goldberg, who I'd completely forgotten about.
Yeah, of course.
I thought that maybe she'd just sort of popped in and popped out, but like she's in a lot of it. Like she's like a big main character.
By all accounts, I think was just a Trekkie and wanted to be in it, as far as I'm aware. I may be misremembering that.
Cause
I'm fairly sure it was like it was one of those things where she kind of was like, no, I wanted to be in it rather than like, I may be wrong, but I've got a feeling,
But that's what would explain it, because this is the early 90s. So she's basically...
She doesn't have to be in Star Trek.
She's at the absolute height of about as famous as a person can be at that point, isn't she? Hasn't she just been in Ghost? And that was like the biggest film in the world.
It would have been about 91, No, a sister act. I'd say actually that is her apex. Yeah, definitely.
So it's really strange seeing her in it. And unfortunately, because it's Star Trek, she's a bloody awful character. Guinan is just such a pain in the ass. But it's like Commander William Riker is just an absolute delight.
Like, he's just...
Of course he is.
Yeah, he's just such an incredibly entertaining person. But, yeah, it's been an absolute joy rewatching it. And you can't do that thing of just, like, picking the best episodes. It's like, I mean, you can, and you'll enjoy it. You'll have a great time.
Agree.
Actually just hitting through it, particularly the first two series, which everyone says are the worst, which are totally not, but they just haven't got any idea of what the tone is yet.
That's the good stuff. When Shaz is trying to work it out. That's always like, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one where it's just like, right, where, okay, that's one where Dick Miller turns up as a 30s newspaper vendor. Yeah, because obviously Dick Miller was only going to play a 30s newspaper vendor in Star Trek. You weren't going to get him to wear a jumpsuit or anything like that.
Yeah. I can't believe he wasn't ever... I mean, he literally looks like he was in Jack Kirby's Newsboy Legion.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got that total vibe, hasn't he? It's
completely. Like, yeah. But yeah, I absolutely have been... We've been having a great time rewatching it. It's just the sheer kind of cosmic darkness of it and shonkiness of it. And just the genuine heartedness, the mediated sense of the vision is actually really fantastic.
And just and seems almost like impossible for that to happen now. You know, like no way could someone just do something. So like you say, so unmediated. Yeah.
Yeah, the only way you could do that now is if you filmed it with your family in your garage. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of, that's almost what it feels like sometimes. Yeah, you know, it really has that vibe to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll finish very quickly on something, which I think, you know, I still want you to see it. So we will probably discuss it as a film itself, but I rewatched Host, Rob Savage's 2020, Zoom based horror.
You know, we've connected with something. We gotta keep going. We gotta talk to it.
It's not good. I told you not to disrespect the spirits. It could be something demonic.
Hey, this is all your fault. Not my fault. This is your fault.
Get in.
Emma, turn the filters off. Come on.
Notable for a few things. One is that it's like 56 minutes long. It's under an hour, which is incredibly, first of all, it kind of works because it's like, you know, Zoom meetings don't last that long. And also it just has the good sense to understand that, you know, it does what it does and it gets out of there. And that's one of the very best things about it. And it's a great, great concept-based bit of horror filmmaking, in the way that I think probably the most underrated and brilliant horror film of the last 10 years is Unfriended.
It's great, that movie.
A totally brilliant movie, and I think utilize technology and limitations in such an incredible way, and is genuinely chilling and unsettling in many, many ways. Just a really phenomenal film. And I think Host does a similar thing of just being like, it's very, very effective by just going, what are some of the things that, you know, that could be creepy about you all sitting in a room on your own at home? And obviously the other thing, as in, like, you know, basically it asks you to look at the shadows behind people and just to constantly be looking around, and in the limited form you have, you're constantly going, what am I looking at here? Where am I directing my thing? But also what's obviously really fascinating about this is it's the lockdown horror film. It was produced, filmed, shot in the first lockdown, which just from a technical level is genuinely like, how the fuck did you do that? That's actually incredible. When you actually think about people all sat at home, you know, because this was the first one. This was when it was really, you know, stay in your home sort of. And so it alludes to it. There's a couple of nice moments where, the whole point of them doing the thing they're doing is because we're all stuck in our houses, which is great. But also it has this kind of strange thing now, watching it this time, like watching it when it came out was like, this is kind of great. This feels completely contemporary and of the moment. And watching it this time, I was like, huh, this is making me feel funny, because I sort of realised we've all lived through something incredibly strange, and the art produced in those first few months is really odd and raw and weird and makes you feel a bit unusual. I had it with there was an episode of a TV show that was the lockdown episode, and it was like, oh yeah, that was really odd. Like, we've all sort of processed it in lots of ways and not processed it. And so Watching Host was just like, gave me this really odd feeling, but it is still a really effective, nasty little movie.
Mm.
And one of the best things about it is that when it gets to the business, it gets to it fast and it goes fucking balls to the wall, and you're like, oh okay, this is good. Like, I think you should watch it. I think you will have a good time with it. So I hope it's been enjoyable listening to us ramble. I think we've enjoyed it for sure.
I don't know about you, Dan, but I've been in need of a good ramble.
Yes, but we'll be back next time with a much more laser focused dissection of some sort of theme for your listening pleasure. But we'll catch you on the flip side, Savage Beasters.
All right, take it easy, guys.
What are we going to do now? Yes, what are we going to do now?